Old Testaments in 2 Samuel chapter 14. We will begin there tonight with the lesson. Sometimes when I'm reading the Bible, I wonder why stories like this are a part of the text. Of all the things that God could have picked to record, we have but a small portion. I mean, anyone understands that of Jesus' life. And John says that if all had been written, the books of the world could not contain it. Think about how large some biographies are sometimes, multi-volumes on George Washington's life. Just men like FDR and others will have many volumes written on them. What could be written about Jesus? But here is what the Holy Spirit picked for us to have for all time. And the story that is told here, as I said to you this morning, we were going to look at the life of David, is a story that will back up into chapter 13 with Amnon, Tamar, and Absalom. In 2 Samuel 14, to just set the context before we read it, there is an unnamed woman from Tekoa. We don't even know what her name is. Tekoa apparently must have been a place that produced this woman, this wise woman she is called. In fact, Joab will send for her. And so the significance of this is that she must have had renown attached to her name and that she had had many such things happen that we'll read about in this story. She will tell a tale. We don't know if it's fictional. There's part of it that happens later in the text that seems to indicate it may be a true story. But it wings its way to David's heart, and it will begin to resolve a festering problem that really is back in chapter 13. This morning we talked about David and some of the defeats that he had, and one of the major ones was, of course, when he sinned with Bathsheba, and God said to him through Nathan the prophet, "The sword will never depart from your house." He had no idea how bad it was going to be. His own son, handsome than any of the others, had risen against him. But all of that was set in motion because of David not doing what he ought to do. So often it is the case with us. Absalom holds in his heart what Amnon had done to his full-blooded sister. Remember that David has several wives. And so Tamar and Absalom share the same mother. Amnon, who's a half-brother, had fallen, he thought, in love with her. But he no sooner takes her and violates her that now his love for her, his hate for her, was even greater than his love had been for her. And you can't even call a word love to say something like that. So she goes away with her hand over her forehead and her mouth crying out. And to Absalom, he knows in his heart what he will do. And so it just takes time for him to plot it out. In chapter 13, beginning at verse 30, we are told the end of the story, that he had called all of these sons of David to him, and they believe now that Absalom has killed everyone. While they were on their way, news came to David, Absalom has struck down all the king's sons, and not one of them is left. How often you ought not to listen to the first word that comes out of anybody. How often it doesn't have all the facts. But Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, said at verse 32, "Let not my lord suppose that they have killed all the young men, the king's son, for Amnon alone is dead." And then it says to us, "For by the command of Absalom, this has been determined from the day he violated his sister Tamar. Now therefore, let not my lord the king so take it to heart as to suppose that all the king's sons are dead, for Amnon alone is dead." But then it says these prescient words, "But Absalom fled," and he really will be in exile from now on. Even when he is called back, he will be in exile. And so we are told at verse 37 that Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Amihud, king of Geshur. Why there? That's his grandfather. David had married outside, apparently, of the Jews, and married a woman that was from another kingdom, which was very common in that day, very common in all the days that have had kings, to try to solidify kingdoms together by, if you marry your son or daughter, nobody will attack one another. But Absalom fled and went to his grandfather, and David mourned for his son day after day. So Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there 3 years will go by. And the spirit of the king longed to go out to Absalom, because he was comforted about Amnon since he was dead. And even though his heart longed to go out to him, he just does nothing. It's as if he is frozen and cannot act as he had not acted when Amnon had done what he had done. Again, because sin so often weakens you, and he had done the same thing that Amnon did. And he does nothing to rectify that situation. He now allows the situation to fester, and it's going to come back to haunt him and what Absalom will eventually do. But let's pick up the story then in chapter 14. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart went out to Absalom. So Joab sent to Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman and said to her, "Pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning garments. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but behave like a woman who has been mourning many days for the dead. Go to the king and speak thus to him." And so Joab put the words in her mouth. He is the one who comes up with the tale. It may be that he knows it was true, maybe not of her, but a true situation or not. It is a tale that is put into the mouth of a woman who knows how to do this. And that is the point. When the woman of Tekoa came to the king, she fell on her face to the ground, paid homage and said, "Save me, O king." And the king said to her, "What is your trouble?" And she answered. She will now tell us the story of two sons. "Alas, I am a widow. My husband is dead, and your servant has two sons. They quarreled with one another in the field. There was no one to separate them, and one struck the other and killed him. And now the whole clan has risen against your servant, and they say, 'Give up the man who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed.' And so they would destroy the heir also. Thus they would quench my coal," the English Standard, you may say flame, "that is left, and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth." She had no other heirs. She had no other sons. So now if they kill this son, everything is taken away. She's lost her husband in death. One son has killed the other. Now she would lose everyone. The family clan becomes, as what she will say, if you look down to verse 11, she will call the avenger of blood. That was something of ancient time. In fact, God regulates it. Remember that He set within all the land of Canaan, and even on the other side where the 2.5 tribes were, that there were cities that were called cities of refuge, and they were strategically placed. They were two in the north on both sides of the Jordan, two in the middle, and then come down in the land two on either side. Why were they called cities of refuge? Well, you didn't have police in that day. You have some kind of force that looked into crime. When something like this happened, a man was to flee as fast as he could to what was called a city of refuge. It was also a Levitical city. There were 48 of those scattered around, but 6 of them were called cities of refuge. If he got there before the avenger of blood found him, for if the avenger of blood came on him before that, he could kill him. And nothing was asked, because he was killing, taking life for life, that life had happened. Whether it was accidental, whether it was purposed, it would be determined by the elders of the city that were in the city of refuge. And if it was found out it was accidental, then he would have to live there the rest of his days according to the rest of the high priest's days, as long as he lived. That may be 5 years, it may be 50 years. But he would have to remain in the city of refuge. Or if he was caught outside of it, his life could be taken. But that's how things were taken in that day. And so she knows that her son, at least as the story is made up, they could put him to death and she would have no more. So David then, we are told, verses 8 through 11, issues his judgment. But it's interesting. It has to take 3 times. "Then the king said to the woman, 'Go to your house. I will give orders concerning you.' The woman of Tekoa said to the king, 'On me be the guilt, my lord the king, and on my father's house let the king and his throne be guiltless.' The king said, 'If anyone says anything to you, bring him to me, and he shall never touch you again.' Then she said, 'Please let the king invoke the Lord your God, that the avenger of blood kill no more, and my son be not destroyed.'" This is not some minor matter. She is pressing him for a whole lot more than he has delivered. Finally, he says, "As the Lord lives," he swears, "not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground." I'll tell you, the first 2 times doesn't satisfy her. It's sort of like David says, "Go home, I'll take care of it." Would that be good enough if it was your son? She presses him again. It's not the passion of the story when Nathan told him that story. Remember, there's been 2 times David now has been caught by a story. He's going to find out he's caught by this one too. When Nathan told that story, David's ire, his anger rose up, and he said, "The man that has done this ought to die." But there's none of that here. Part of that may be in the story itself, because he hasn't dealt with his own family.
The woman presses him again. David replies a bit stronger. Finally, she presses him a third time. And now David swears by Jehovah, no one will cause one hair of your son to fall to the ground. And then she says, come here. May I have a private word with you. Please let your servant speak a word to my lord the king. He said, speak. The woman said, why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in giving this decision, the king convicts himself, and as much as the king does not bring his banished one home again, we must all die. We are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. But God will not take away life, and he devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast. Now, I have come to say this to my lord the king because the people have made me afraid, and your servant thought, I will speak to the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his servant. But the king will hear and deliver his servant from the hand of the man who would destroy me and my son together from the heritage of God. And your servant thought, the word of my lord the king will set me at rest, for my lord the king is like the angel of God to discern good and evil. The Lord your God be with you. The woman of Tekoa basically says to David, you are the one, King David, just like Nathan had said. Now she has caught him with the story once again as Nathan had. You are the one who is taking a life, as she will say, and preventing the banished one, Absalom, from returning home. Do you want to lose him too, is the point. As I would lose my own son. Basically, she is saying, have mercy. But I want you to focus, as we will tonight, on verse 14. Because this woman, and maybe why the story is here, even though it fills out the story of Absalom, it's not absolutely necessary. But verse 14 is absolutely necessary, and so is the story. If we understand it in a larger context, we must all die. Listen to her. We are like water spilled upon the ground. Those people in this audience that are young, you don't get this yet. I didn't either. The longer you live in life, as I've said to you, stuff begins to hurt that didn't hurt once, and things happen where you've got to take this pill to correct that matter. And then before long, you have so many pills that you've got to get one of those little plastic cases that you know what you take on Monday. I'm not there yet, so don't smile at me like that. On Tuesday, on Wednesday, and so forth. But eventually, everything wears out. And we look back on our life, and our minds are still the same. We're still young. We still look back on all the things that you are just ahead of you. All the joys, all the anticipation, all of that. We look back on our life. Maybe it is that we regret some things. As we talked about this morning, maybe it is there are things we cannot change. But we realize death is closer, far closer than it was when we were your age. But we are all like water spilled on the ground. It cannot be gathered up again. Our lives are undone as far as we are considered physically. And that will happen to each one of us in time. Then she says these words that also need to be understood. But God will not take away life. And He devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast. God devises means to bring back the banished one. And that is profound wisdom. More profound than she could probably understood. But in the greater context of the Bible, that is exactly the story of the Bible. The God of redemption. Man is banished because of what? His sin before his Father. His sin before his God. Of all the stories that you read, what do you read each time you read them? They went away. They were banished because of their sin. There is a separation that takes place always. In the end, it is a separation of life. We die because of the consequences of sin. It has entered this world. Even innocent babies die from a consequence that happened because Adam and Eve did what they did. Sin separates the soul, the body, that is death. but always it separates us from God. And so when Adam and Eve sinned, He drove out the man. At the east of the Garden of Eden, He placed a cherubim, an angel, and a flaming sword that turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life. When Cain murders Abel, his brother, Genesis 4:14 says, "Behold, you have driven me today away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." And the Lord said, "If anyone kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attack him. And then it says these words, "Cain went away from the presence of the Lord." And so will all of his descendants be people that do not serve the Lord, the ones that from Seth did. It is, again, words that mean much. Sin separates us from God. And then when Israel goes into captivity, how many times do you read words like this, "And the nation shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity"? When Peter in the New Testament denies the Lord, what happens? That third denial, the Lord turned and looked at him. I don't know if you've ever seen Mel Gibson's story of the Passion, but Jesus is beaten, bloodied, and on the ground. And so Peter ends up somehow in that, fallen on the ground too. And Jesus turns and looks through people's legs. There's space enough to see. And Peter looks at him in the eye. Did exactly what Jesus told he would do. "Before the rooster crows this day, you will deny me three times." And it says this, he went out and wept bitterly. Sin separates you from God. And so Judas Iscariot would betray the Lord, and when he would just be overcome with what he has done, he says, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood," and he brings back the money, and they said, "We're not taking it back." And he threw it down in the temple. And he departed, and he went and hanged himself. Sin always separates man from God. But the great story of the Bible is this story of redemption, in which God will bring back the banished one. And the way that He does that is He does it through Jesus Christ, His Son. Notice what she said first. God doesn't take away life. That is not what God does. God is a giver of life. In John 10 and verse 10, Jesus told the story of the thief and the good shepherd. And he says, "The thief only comes to kill and destroy, but listen to him. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly." I came to give them life as they have never known it. As any one of us cannot know. Not yet. Only now do we partially partake of it. I know fully in the sense that it is coming, but we're going to die here, but not there. When Jesus says in John 3 verse 16 that He doesn't want anyone to perish, that is the greatest perishing, to be eternally separated from God. He is not willing that any man should perish, but that all should come to Jesus. They all should know that by believing in Him they will have life. And so she says the second thing, God devises means to bring back the banished one. She could not even probably fully understand what she spoke. God did devise means. Galatians, the third chapter, and at verse 10, Paul wrote, "For all who rely on works of the law are under a curse, if we think that we will get there by our keeping the law, then we're all under the curse because we've all sinned against Him. Cursed be everyone," he quotes the law, "who does not abide by all things written in the book of the law and do them." The only way you can be justified by a law system is do them. Do them and never violate them. Now it is evident that no one is justified, pronounced not guilty before God by the law. For the righteous, he quotes that great statement that is made more than something like three times in the Old Testament. The righteous shall live by faith. That's Hebrews 11 this morning that we were studying in this audience. But the law is not of faith. They're mutually exclusive ways by which God justifies. God justifies by our faith in Him. The law is not of faith. Rather, the one who does them, that's how you're justified by law, says him, you do them. But faith is another thing. Faith is trusting God. Not because God had to do this. The greatness of it all is that God would do it in the first place. That He would sit there and watch as they beat His Son. He would sit there and watch as they crammed a crown of thorns on His forehead and made Him begin to bleed. And then His back became just slivers of, as one man said, quivering flesh and just unbelievable. You couldn't even look at a back and see it was a back anymore. And then they would take Him to a cross and nail Him to it. And God the Father would watch this and not annihilate every last one of us. He could have just spoken and we would have ceased to exist. He could have tortured us if He had wanted to. He had every right to. But God devises means to bring back the banished one. So that He became, He said, the curse for us. As it is written, cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree. Or as Paul writes in Ephesians 1 verse 7, in Him, in Jesus, we have redemption through His blood. Redemption is that business of buying us back, of ransoming us back as you would a slave in ancient times by paying whatever price to free them. God redeemed us through costly measures, the blood of Jesus. The forgiveness of trespasses according to the riches of His grace. Or as Paul would tell the elders at Ephesus, for you to care for the church of God which He obtained with His own blood. And that's how we were redeemed. Redemption is costly because it always requires lifeblood. Someone must die. In the Old Testament, that would take the life of an animal. But it was you. Have you ever thought about that? I don't know how many sacrifices would be offered on a given day by people that had sins. You ever try to clean up blood? Can you imagine when you shoot animals and it ends up on your bumper of your truck and you wash it all out and you clean it up and you try to get rid of it, or if it's a deer or something that's bigger like that, how much can happen? Every animal that is brought, you lay your hand on its head, so as signifying this animal dies in my stead. You kill it. You slit its throat and let its blood pour out. You catch it in a basin, the priest does, so that he can now go around and put sometimes some on the horns of the altar. Imagine, I always wondered, did they wash it down after they were done, or was it always the remains of it left there? They threw it or poured it against the base altar, sometimes threw it in sprinkling, as it were, upon the altar itself. As Ralph Walker said one time, can you imagine the flies that were there? You ever done that for any length of time and think about how many flies must have been there? And blood after blood, so that we are told in Solomon's time when they sacrificed those hundreds and hundreds of sacrifices, blood ran ankle deep. So we sit in air conditioning and padded pews and we come on a Sunday. We don't even recognize how costly it is. I've said to you before that if you look at people that you love, you realize that you would do a great deal for them. If somebody had cancer, you would find out that you're the match. They're going to take bone marrow from you. Who of us would not do that? And what if you, one of my brothers, finds out that their kidney is failing, both of them, but I am a perfect match? Who of us, if we truly loved, would not go under the knife and give gladly one of our kidneys? We're going to suffer more than the person. The person is going to get instantly better almost when a good, healthy kidney is placed in them. But we will have to recover from that. And the body will have to learn to work with one. There's not one of you that I would even think about giving Jonathan to you. You must kill him so that you may live. I would not do that. And neither would you. But God. Oh, he could have killed his son with the swipe of a sword. No, he brings him in the fullness of time to where the death that he will die will be by one of the most torturous things that men have ever devised, to exact excruciating pain in order to somehow get to us that this is what it takes to redeem. God devises means. I wish the story ended there. Oh, how I wish it ended there. But the king answered the woman, verse 18, "Do not hide from me anything I ask you." The woman said, "Let the Lord my king speak." Is the hand of Joab in this? Well, he finds out it is. Joab comes in and he sends Joab. He says, "Okay, I get it. Go get Absalom. But I want you to read verse 24 because these are as important words for the chapter's meaning, but they are terrible words." And the king said, "Let him dwell apart in his own house. He is not to come into my presence." I thought his heart longed to go out to him. I thought he was comforted about Amnon. But Absalom comes back, verse 28, and lives 2 full years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence. So Joab, he sends to Joab. Joab won't respond to him, so he says, okay. So he sends field of grain. He sends his servants out, set it on fire. Absalom comes running. Joab does, and says, "What are you doing?" He said, "I sent for you and you wouldn't come, and I sent for you and you wouldn't come. So I set your field on fire so you'd come. Behold," he says to him, "why have I come from Geshur? It would have been better," verse 32, "for me to still be there. I'm still in exile. Now therefore, let me go into the presence of the king. If there's guilt, then let him kill me. Put me to death." And Joab went to the king and told him, and he summoned Absalom. And so he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king. Listen to it. And the king kissed him. But the icy coldness of the separation had already wreaked its havoc in the heart of Absalom. I'll tell you, the terrible tragedy of this story is that God forgives and man does not. God devises means by which the banished one can come home. He does not kill. He comes to give life. How tragic when fellow men have been forgiven so much by their God, fail to love their fellow as much as God loved them. Does that sound familiar to you? It should. Matthew 18. Peter asked, "If a man sins against me, my brother, shall I forgive him 3 times? Probably says 7. He said, "I'll just go." Peter says, "I'll go 7. Jesus said, "I do not say to 70 times, but 70 times 7. Then he tells the story of 2 servants. One that comes before his king and owes him 10,000 talents. Folks, we can't understand that number except that not even Palestine and Syria owed that much to the Roman government. They owed something like 800 talents a year. This is an impossible sum. And when he begs him for mercy, his Lord grants him mercy. He's going to sell his entire family, your children, all your precious ones into slavery, pay off a little bit of it. And out of pity, the master forgives him. So this guy goes out and immediately finds one of his fellow servants who owes him 300 denarii, about 3 months' pay, if you consider a denarius a day, was the common wage of that time. And literally, the English Standard says rightly, the Greek word is, he choked him. He grabbed him by the throat and said, pay me all that you owe me. He begged him for mercy. But he threw him into prison, debtor's prison, until he could pay all the debt. And some of the other servants saw it and were greatly distressed and went and told the king. And the king had him hauled in. And he said, you wicked servant. I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. And should you not have had mercy on your fellow servant as I had mercy on you? And in anger his master delivered him to the jailers until he should pay all of the 10,000 talents. So also, Jesus says, my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother from your heart. Oh, the calamity of failing to forgive. The Bible exhorts us, doesn't it? Forgiving each other as the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. If a brother sins in the congregation or a sister sins in the congregation, what are we to do? The Apostle Paul said to the Corinthians, for such a one, this punishment by the majority is enough. So you should rather turn to forgive and comfort him. Listen to him. Or he may be overwhelmed by excessive sorrow. So I beg you to reaffirm your love for him. Oh, I'll forgive him. But I'm going to keep my eye on him. Oh, I'll forgive him. I guarantee you, I'll tell my wife, we're never having him over to the house. Ever. Oh, we'll forgive him. If they come crawling down on their bellies in the middle of this aisle and plead for forgiveness, when they're humiliated enough, we'll forgive them. I'll tell you, the Bible has one answer to that attitude. Hell. We will all go to hell. And we will know why. When we stand before the King. David did not forgive Absalom. He had learned nothing. And it wreaked terrible havoc. It always does. The story never ends well, does it? If we will not fully forgive the one who has offended. May God help us. That woman of Tekoa, unnamed, spoke beyond anything she could have understood. May we be people that understand how much we need God. May we not do what David did. If you're subject to heaven's invitation this night, Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. He that believes not shall be condemned. If we can help you tonight to come to Him, we bid you come as together we stand and sing.